Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes, and this is the audio diary of my life behind the scenes of a YouTube creator on the 22nd of June, 2025. Yesterday was the longest day, the summer solstice, and today is the following morning. We had, as far as I can tell, and I was asleep a little bit of it during the night, well, most of it, but we did have some rain. But it didn't seem to last long. It came thunderously down, and I did think we would have some thunder with it and perhaps some lightning, but then it stopped. I'm having a glass of milk as I talk to you. Raw milk, of course. Very lovely and most delicious. And it's a bit cloudy at the moment, 6:30 in the morning, or just coming up to. But still very warm, which is fine with me. As long as we get some more rain, then we're having a perfect summer. Despite the chemtrailing, which they did do yesterday morning, and it did cloud over. And I don't know whether what it was like. Excuse me, yawning. I don't know what it was like at Stonehenge and around that sort of area where people would have been celebrating the summer solstice and presumably wanting to look up into the sky and, you know, align with stars and things. And maybe the spoil sports managed to overcast the sky, so it interrupted that. I don't know. Yesterday, the majority of the morning up till pretty much the mid-afternoon was taken up with two things. One, logs, which arrived at just by 9 o'clock, actually. In the morning, I did, of course, the Naked Englishman. I did a video. Logs came in, and then I was concentrating on writing. I get through pretty much all my emails, and I was writing. That was really, excuse me, the last big scene of the book. It's now the epilogue that I need to concentrate on today. Winding up, really, what all the characters that we've met and just where they go, what happens, you know, sort of. I don't think it's going to be very long. I don't want it to be very long because there's a number of characters and they may get like a paragraph each, and that's about it, really. Because when you've come to the conclusion of the book, it is just that gentle wind down. And I think I've mentioned it before, it's a bit like an aeroplane. Maybe I mentioned it was like this. But you have the beginning, people get into, you know, they arrive at the airport and what have you, and they go through passport control and they get onto the aeroplane. And then there's the great dramatic takeoff, which sets the scene for the whole book. You've got the flight, which is the main arc of the story, and then you've got the denouement. Thank you for whoever it was who sent me the dictionary thing, the denouement. I can never remember how to pronounce it, that's the trouble. The denouement, or whatever it is, of the end of the story, where it all comes together and all the ends tie up and we get the final bit. And then there's just, really, I suppose, there's the, some people don't bother with it, because the you know, like in a whodunit, it's like, and the person who did it was Fred, with the lead piping in the study. You don't need much more than that, because that was really what the whole point was. Well, who did it? It was Fred. Oh, okay, great. But sometimes you do need just that hint at what, you know, the, it's not quite, and they lived happily ever after. It's like, well, they did okay. This happened to them, you know, they're meandering on. And that also, I think, leaves it open for a second story. Either with the same characters, or some of the same characters, or the same theme. You know, you're sort of trailing it out. Anyway, so that's all I've got to do now, which is great. And I'll just put my glasses on. I wanted to tell you about, so that was all that happened. What else? Oh, I had a conversation with Julia I cooked. I knew you were going to come in if I opened the door. Yeah, she's. I heard the tinkling of the foots of the cat. You want some food, don't you? Well, don't panic because I've already got the food ready for you to go. So let's put it on a plate and away you go. Come on in. Come on. And he'll probably turn his nose up at it. Yeah, I had a conversation with Julia and then. What did I have? Bacon. Oh. Yeah, so I made some sausages and egg and bacon and peas last night because I was on my own. Julia was doing her children looking after thing. And it's coming. It's coming, young fella. I just need to find a plate. And I got the fire going because I got these new logs. I had a load of offcuts, as it were, twigs and, the small kindlingy bits. So I was burning provisionally, principally, those. But in doing so, hang on, Catty. I hate this food because if it smells so rank, and if you get it on your fingers, it stinks. And as you push it out the, here we go. And also the packets, the food attracts flies. Because it's meat, it's real meat. Flies don't go to artificial cat food, do they? Because they know there's all sorts of chemicals in it. Whereas there's no chemicals in this stuff. But it means I have to put the little sachet it comes in. Cat's enjoying it. Into a doggy bag. So the smell may come out. But I had maggots all over the floor the other day where I'd failed to do this. And I think a lump of meat went under the counter. There we go. Yeah, you just have to be a bit careful. In fact, I should just shut this door for the moment. Because now I have to pick up the. In the height of the summer, if he doesn't eat all of it, and sometimes he doesn't, I have to put it in the fridge because otherwise the flies just come and lay their eggs on it. Anyway, well, that was all very interesting. So yesterday came, I did also film the pipe smoking video, which is out tomorrow, today. And just as I was setting up, there was a knock at the door, and a chap was delivering parcels. And he gave me this little parcel. I thought, what the hell is that? I opened it up and it was a lovely book. And the interesting thing about this, I do show it on the pipe smoking video. And I've got a similar book, but not the same one, by the same author, Frances Mountford. I don't know how many other books she wrote, but she was obviously a watercolorist and a drawer, and she wrote a book about the Second World War, Heartbreak Hotel, I think, Heartbreak Hotel, Heartbreak Farm, I believe it was called. Anyway, it was very helpful in my research for the book I was writing about the Second World War, a children's book, which I'm going to adapt actually because all of it will make a very interesting. Just got to write it in a slightly different way. I think it would be making a very interesting novel. Anyway, this one that came is called A Commoner's Cottage, and I remember I was emailed by a lady called Rona, who said, I've got this book and it's all about, I've been going through my books and it's all about a cottage through the ages. Would you like it? And I said, I'd love it. I'd love it. The story of a cottage through the ages, A Commoner's Cottage. And what's lovely about this book is it isn't in your normal type of book with just loads of text and a couple of pictures. It's these watercolours and illustrations and pen and ink and all sorts of things. And I don't know whether this is a type font or it just looks like, I think it must be a type font because it looks as if it's been handwritten, but I don't think it has because the writing is just too neat and too uniform. But it fits the style of what she does, this lady who draws these pictures. So I thought I'd just randomly again pull some bits out. The first bit I wanted to do is in the 21st year of the reign of Elizabeth I in the county of Surrey, England, John Simmons, aged 23, married Winifred Chasemore, aged 29. Chasemore, oh yeah, he's not the same. Mount, what's the name of the author's book? Mountford. I thought maybe it was related to her, but it isn't. 1579, there are Dorking registers. And it says these two characters, who John and Winifred, they were both from the manor of Dorking, where they lived and worked together afterwards for the rest of their lives. John and Winifred Simmons had four children, all baptised at St. Martin's Church in Dorking, and they were Agnes, John and Thomas. And what's interesting is John was baptised in 1585, buried in 1586. He didn't last very long. Poor little bugger. Anyway, it tells a story of this house and how, you know, who it went to and I guess what happened to it. There's a picture of Leith Hill Tower here. And so on and so forth. Anyway, it's just beautifully illustrated, but I'll read a bit out. It shows where it is as well. Dorking, Holmwood Common, Bear Green and Capel. Now the interesting thing is I drive up through this on the A24 time after time after time. So many times, so I would have passed this little cottage, wherever it is. Although there's a map that she's drawn, I'm just trying to see where it would be. Can't see it on the map, but anyway, it needs a bit of study. Right, so here we go. Building a new house. Let's see what this bit says. It says here, building the new house. In the winter of 1592 or 1593, oaks for the new house were felled. The oaks would have been between 40 and 100 years old, growing straight and tall through coppiced hazel. While the wood was still green, it was easier to saw and to shape with an adze. When allowed to weather for a year or more, oak becomes so hard and tough it quickly dulls the axe. That's an interesting point, really, I suppose. I hadn't thought of it. Yeah, once it's seasoned, it's much harder work than doing it when it was green. I knew that the old timber frame houses were doing it green, but I hadn't thought that actually that may be the reason that it dulls the axe. But of course, as it dries out, it changes its shape. The milk was lovely, by the way. The trees require only a little squaring off to neaten them up and to make them into the main load-bearing beams of the house. For the smaller beams, some trunks would have... I'm not reading this very well, because it is in handwriting, remember. Although I think that has potentially a... I'm just looking to see if this... No. I think this has been written by hand and printed. But it's very straight. But when you look at two different Fs, for example, or two different... All the font is not a uniform font. That's interesting. How brilliant is that? So where were we? The trees would require a little squaring off to neaten them up and to make them off the main load-bearing beams. For the smaller beams, some trunks would be riven by hammering wedges into them until they split lengthwise. Each tree trunk, as it was riven, was and shaped, was made for its allotted place in the plan of the house. The greatest timbers were for the sills, which would lie flat on the ground and upon which the entire house would rest. Next in size were the main vertical posts. Then there were long and thick tie beams, arch braces for the corners, and short and more slender studs. The floorboards, being broad and flat, had to be sawn over a pit, with one man in the pit itself, sawdust falling all over him, and one man at the other end of the saw, standing above. The floorboards, however, were usually made of softer wood than oak. Many of them measure 18 inches wide. So, yeah, and carpenter's assembly marks are written on there. Holes to take vertical slots. It's all illustrated. And these carpenter assembly marks are often mistaken, and I've said this before, often mistaken for marks made by sailors on a ship. And they say, oh yeah, these old timbers were... But actually, these marks are, as it says, they are assemble makers. So, really, really interesting, you know, and very simplistic, but very interesting. Oxen hauled the ready-shaped timbers to John Simmons' patch of land on the green. As the ground round about was liable to be wet and heavy, the carpenter probably waited for a sharp frost to before the hauling. The timbers would have been laid out in a rough order on the ground, with several men setting about the task of erecting the framework of the house. Then the air would have been loud with the sound of the heart oak pegs being hammered into the holes of the mortise and tenon joints, with the rattle and creaking of the pulley lifting the heavy timbers, and the chopping and the sawing of the carpenter as he made a little more leeway in a joint, or took an inch or two off the main beam. As the oak dried out, it would move and shrink. In years to come, it would harden like iron, and after that, it would settle and shift hardly at all. The framework of the house stood gaunt, an angular wooden skeleton, awaiting the arrival of tiles, bricks, and wattle and daub for the walls. Despite the opinions of some people that south-facing houses were susceptible to plague, or bearing winds, or plague-bearing winds, John Simmons' house faced southwards, so that the sunlight could shine into the mullioned windows and warm the rooms, especially in winter time when the sun rode low across the sky and its rays could penetrate to the furthest wall of the hearth room. Excuse me, being a bit sniffed up. It's fascinating, isn't it? And when you can see the pictures, of course, you can't actually see them. It is a most delightful book. And this came out in 1990, I think. It says here, first published in 1992 and then reprinted in 1995. So, some time ago. I wonder if the lady who wrote it, Frances Mompford, is still alive. And probably. I mean, there's no reason why not. I was alive in 1992. Depends how old she was when she did this. But these are delightful books that she's done. I'll read last bit, which is about bricks. Just as the area grew fine oak trees, so the Wildon clay was perfect for making bricks. Despite an abundance of local clay, bricks were expensive, for it was slow and laborious work to make them. The clay had to be dug from the ground in autumn and left in heaps to temper over the winter. Not till the end of March did brickmaking begin. But then, if the weather was wet and the bricks would not dry out and could not be fired until fine weather came again, only rich people could afford to have the whole of the infilling between the timber framework built up with bricks. Husbandmen of John's status had to settle for walls made of wattle and daub. Bricks were a necessity around the fireplace for the smoke bay. And then it talks about the wattle and daub. For the wattle and daub, lathes of oak about 2.5 inches wide were, what's that word? Rived or rived. And these were sprung into slots that had been left by the carpenter in the beams of the house. Across the lathes, or laths, as some people say, hazel rods were then woven. When all was finished, the walls resembled a wicker basket. Next, the dauber came to mix what looked like mud pies. The daub was a mixture of clay, cow dung, lime, chaff and sheep's wool. And when it was of the correct consistency, he expertly slapped it across the oak laths and hazel rods so that it lay smooth. The sheep's wool prevented the daub cracking up as it dried. I imagine it added a level of insulation. While the daub was still wet, the dauber roughened the surface with a bunch of birch twigs so that the lime plaster, which would be thinly applied over the top, would easily adhere to it. How about that? I'm going to enjoy just sitting there with a pipe reading that book. It's absolutely lovely. And again, it's reminding me stuff that I know, but adding stuff that I don't know, and that's always a good thing, isn't it? I thought I had some tissue paper down here just to blow my honker. I'm going to go in a second. But don't you find that fascinating? I think to have had one of those houses without plastics, without chemical stuff, but with basics, you know, a bit of lime, wash, cow dung, mud, some chaff and wool, and you just mix it up, slap it on, it hardens and it holds together, it does what it's supposed to do for hundreds of years. Remember this stuff, and these timber oaks are still standing. These are Tudor houses, Elizabethan houses, whatever you want to call them, the old black and white ones. It's just remarkable. Excuse me. And, yeah, they may have been small in retrospect to what we are so used to. And perhaps they, some people wouldn't like them. I've been in several of these houses and they are just wonderful. There's a real earthy sense to them, and they're connected to the ground and they're made from natural things. So many modern houses are just not, and I think all of that contributes to a certain separation from the earth and what we're supposed to be doing and so how we're supposed to live. I think we've expanded to a point that we've almost forgotten. For me, at least, exposing in my Victorian house the brick and the old lime render, as much as I have, really helps. And surrounding it with books and wood in my, certainly these two shelf units. And things like that are, they just resonate. Anyway, thank you for listening. I will catch up with you tomorrow, no doubt. I'm going to do some more writing today. Make myself a cup of coffee shortly. I've got to record my daily monologue and then crack on. And it's, what is it? Probably about 7 in the morning. Very quiet, very peaceful. Might have a quiet meditation now. And then upload this in a minute. Take care. Thanks very much for listening. Bye for now.